Okay, I'm going to call this meeting to order. We are the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. It is Thursday, July 21st, 2016. Welcome, members, and people who are watching us, and people who are on the phone. I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the task force chair. I represent Senate District 23 in the Oregon Senate. And to my left is...
Are you sure I'm not to your right?
Depends on how you look at it.
I would say on this issue, no.
I'm Jackie Winters. I represent Senate District 10.
Jeremy?
Jeremy Nichols. We're from Mercy Corps Northwest, and I'm the housing advocate on the panel.
I'm Jen Netherwood. I work for Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute. I'm a journey-level carpenter.
Great.
And I'm Truls Neal. I work with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, also representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors.
I'm Serena Stoudemire-Wesley. I'm Director of Diversity and Inclusion and Affirmative Action for Governor Brown.
And I'm Paul Solomon. I'm the Executive Director at Sponsors, a reentry organization in Lane County, and the Chair of our Local Public Safety Coordinating Council.
Great.
Zoe Larmer, Committee Staff.
Yeah. And we have Shelley.
Shelley Master, Committee Assistant.
Oh, great. And on the phone, who do we have?
Hi, this is Eddie Allen. I'm the Vice President of Academic Affairs at Treasure Valley Community College.
Hey, Eddie. Good to hear from you. Who else?
And Mike Schmidt, Director of the Criminal Justice Commission.
Great. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
And
Parish, Parish Off District 37.
Okay. Welcome, Julie. And in the room, we also have Sybil Hebb back there from the Oregon Law Center. And I'm going to be asking Sybil to make a couple of comments to us in just a moment. So, colleagues, what we have on the agenda today, for the most part, are issues that came up at our last meeting, where they came up in the course of presentations on different subjects. And they seemed to me, all of them, to be, you know, I sensed that there was interest in our pursuing these ideas, talking more about them. You know, I want to gauge more clearly the sense of the task force. Are these areas that we want to move forward on and perhaps look at, you know, either legislation or further conversations that could lead to legislation? Before we do that, Commissioner, you want to introduce yourself?
Janet Carlson, Marion County.
Welcome. Okay. So the first item on the agenda is Senate Bill 91, and this came up in our discussion of housing and the barriers that ex-offenders face with respect to housing. One of the presenters mentioned to us that in 2013 we passed Senate Bill 91, which had to do well. As a result of it, arrests that did not result in convictions could not be used as a reason for a landlord to deny housing to a tenant, and also a five-year limit was put on where a person's adverse eviction history couldn't be considered for an eviction that was longer than 5 years. And it was suggested to us that we might want to look at that, look at perhaps expanding on Senate Bill 91 in terms of the offenses that that are considered, and also perhaps some sort of, 5-year limit with respect to offenses, something along those lines. And so So I'd like us to, I'd like to get your thoughts about this. And also, you know, one of the things that came up was the issue of disparate impact. I don't know if you remember that conversation. And that came up in the context of a Supreme Court decision, which suggested that blanket prohibitions that could be deemed to have an adverse impact on certain groups of people really should not be used. And that obviously really, so while the landlords are still trying to figure out what that means, and HUD has given some indication but not conclusive, this obviously is very relevant to what we're talking about here. And I asked Sybil if she would maybe come up and say a few words, because the Oregon Law Center has been very involved with this issue, and she let me know that actually disparate impact is something that has been considered for many years here in Oregon. So I wonder if you could tell us more, please, Sybil.
Sure. Thank you very much, Chair Drembo. And first of all, I just want to say I'm Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, which is a legal aid provider. We do civil legal assistance to low-income people throughout Oregon. And housing, of course, is a huge priority for us. And it's really probably the single most important issue to our clients in every one of the counties where we work, because it's so connected to a person's ability to care for themselves and their family and to get access to health care and have stable education and job history and so much more, which I know you're all so familiar with. So I want to first just say thank you so much for the work that you're doing and the focus that you're bringing to this. And then I just have a little caveat, because while this is really incredibly important to the Law Center, there are experts in our firm who do these cases on a much more daily basis. And so, you know, I could come today and want to talk about things from a policy perspective. If you want more specific technical information, I'd be happy to arrange for another time when I could have some of my my experts come. But I just wanted to get to that point that you were mentioning, Chair Dembro. The theory of disparate impact and sort of how you assess whether a policy or a rule has a discriminatory impact on a protected class, a protected population, that's a theory that many people have used in case law and in trying to assess situations nationally over many, many years. Oregon codified that theory, the disparate impact theory, in our state statutes in 2008, and it's in Chapter 659A, which is where much of our discrimination legislation is. And that, it's the specific site is 659A.425, and it reads, violation based on facially neutral housing policy can be considered discriminatory if it's some, even if it wasn't intending to be discriminatory on a protected class, if it is a facially neutral policy that has a discriminatory impact, then it's to be assessed in the same way a discrimination claim would be assessed, essentially. There are nuances, but that's the basic gist. And so we're lucky in Oregon that we, that you all took the steps to codify that theory way back in 2008. The recent Supreme Court decision from the fall or winter of 2015 acknowledged and sort of agreed that that theory also held true under federal law. That theory had been challenged, and the Supreme Court upheld it as good law. It has not been codified anywhere in the federal law. So we have the Supreme Court decision that said, yes, you can use this in this case that came out of Texas. And then we have the other most tangible thing that we have is this HUD opinion letter from April of 2016, just recently, which is of greater sort of strength, if you will, than many other HUD issuances. Usually they will issue a guidance. This was an opinion from their lead counsel, so it's a stronger piece from HUD. But that's the guidance that we have at the federal level that gives us the concrete analysis. And there are many gaps in that. And so there's still a lot more, I think, that the folks at the federal level are trying to figure out what this theory means as it's applied to housing providers. And we have been told, the Law Center has been participating in some national discussions with other civil rights and fair housing and legal aid attorneys to try to follow this and see where we think it's going. And we've had representatives of HUD come and speak to that group, and they have indicated that they'll hoping to provide some more guidance by the end of the year or the beginning of next year. So we don't know yet what that will look like. But that's sort of the lay of the land and how, or that as we know it, and how it interfaces with Oregon statute. So.
Yes,
Jenny. Thank you. A couple questions. One is, you mentioned protected class, and so I'm trying to, and I didn't memorize the HUD guidance, so it, you know, but I, sure. kind of the gist of it was that at least the way that it's playing out in the conversations I've been involved with is that landlords are being told they should not use criminal background checks to determine whether or not people are suitable to go into their apartments if they're involved in Section 8 or whatever. And of course, public housing would follow that as well. So, are you saying that it, under Oregon law, it sounds like it applies to protected class? Under federal law, does it also apply to protected class? And if it does, is it just the impact is more general in order to avoid the impact on the protected class, or could someone come and say, well, we can run background checks on white guys, but do you see what I'm saying? I mean, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on what the parameters are.
I think I understand what you're saying, and I think the answer is that in both Oregon's disparate impact theory as codified in the statute and also as we understand the HUD guidelines, nobody's saying you can't ever consider criminal history. What they're saying is, because I failed to articulate this earlier, so I apologize for that, is the data shows that criminal history has such a disparate impact on people who are members of a protected class.
Okay.
Specifically, the data that I'm aware of shows an extreme negative impact or disparate impact on African-American populations and also on Latino populations. There's probably data that shows the same thing on other populations that I'm not yet aware of, but that was the basis, and that analysis is what led the Supreme Court and then HUD to say, see this disparate impact reflected so clearly in the data, we therefore think that this using criminal history as a means of screening people out of housing is going to have this impact on people who are protected classes. And so you need to be able to justify any use of criminal history by giving it basically heightened scrutiny to make sure that what you're giving an individualized assessment of a person, their background, and what the mitigation factors have been, what rehabilitation efforts have been made, how long ago the history was, and that kind of thing, so that you're not making assumptions, but you're rather looking at the facts of
that
the
makes
case.
Sense. Can I do one follow-up?
Yes, please.
So Cindy Roberts, I think, was
right.
the yeah. lobbyist that was here last meeting, and I was really taken with one of the things that she talked about, which was that she had gone to Eastern Oregon and that someone from the prison had been there and spoken about risk assessments as opposed to criminal background. So I've actually raised this issue in a couple meetings that I've been in since I was at this meeting hearing that about whether or not it would make sense to work with our landlords and our reentry population to help them see what the risk to recidivate is as opposed to looking at a criminal background, which research is showing doesn't have much relationship anyway to how people are going to proceed in the future. So would the risk assessment also be considered if someone used a risk assessment rather than using a criminal background and they used it over an entire population of reentry, no matter whether they were protected class or not, would that still cause problems legally under this HUD guidance? I guess that's my question.
I think it's a good question, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I think the basic gist is that if any formula is probably not going to satisfy the requirements, because I think what they're saying is you need to do an individualized assessment, and it's rare that any one person is going to have the same exact set of criteria. So I think there may be a set of criteria or risk factors that you could universally look at for everybody. I would think you'd also probably need to have a general sort of some other category, and I think you'd need to look at people's individualized experiences And I don't know exactly how much or what we're going to hear from HUD. And I know there are many other experts on this panel who have thoughts about that.
I think what you're saying, Sybil, as long as the tool does not continue any form of discrimination in any form.
Mm-hmm. A blanket kind of.
Which, if I could just say, I mean, the tools that we use, and I'm sure they use them in Multnomah County and Lane County and the other counties that are represented here, are evidence-based tools, and they're looking at the risk factors that someone has and whether, with those risk factors, they're likely to be successful or less likely to be successful. So in a sense, they are individualized, right, because you're looking at the risk profile of the individual person, and then in some ways with consultation with the parole officer or whatever, saying this person is a good bet, where ordinarily someone looks at that criminal background and says, you've got this felony, or, you know, you're this, you're that, and we're not going to have you in the apartment. I mean, I see them as somewhat two different sides of the coin, yeah. But I just didn't know how the law would see that and what cautions you'd need to have and before you started going down that path.
Well, and I think that you're exactly right that, you know, there are many individual criteria that you could look at in any, you know, as a part of your standard mm-hmm. assessment, but as long as you don't, and I would think that using that kind of a tool would be helpful, and as long as it wasn't having a blanket sort of impact on people, and it was still retaining an individualized assessment. And I think that something critical to that analysis is to have the opportunity for some sort of an appeal, you know, because you may not be able to predict what questions you should have asked of a person or an applicant that might have led to an assessment that someone had been rehabilitated or that mm-hmm. there were mitigating factors. And so I think, you know, I'm not the expert, and we haven't heard from the federal government or for the Supreme Court direct answers to all of those good questions. And, you know, I think we're all trying to figure that out right now and see what that kind of nitty-gritty, if you will play out to be. Mm-hmm.
We did hear that, I mean, the further challenge is, you know, while, you know, it's desired to do individual assessments, that can also lead you into a different kind of discrimination, right, where you're being inconsistent in how you apply your, you know, criteria. And I can understand there being some challenges for landlords, right, in just knowing what to do and how, I mean, are the landlords actually equipped to do these kinds of assessments? That's the one question that I would have. And are there ways that we could provide them with some guidance or some better certainty?
Or they'd get the assessment from the professionals that had done them in sort of a portfolio type of a look, as opposed to just here's your application and thumbs up, thumbs down.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the certificate that we had talked about, and I wasn't.
Well, that can be one tool.
That can be one tool. I think, you know, and what's happening is to try to get rid of, whether we're talking about the criminal justice system or other systems, to stop the institutional, whether it is in housing or other forms of racism that exist. I mean, let's just put it out there and be honest of what we're trying to, what's being addressed in this particular issue and other issues, to where that it becomes what's good for the goose will become goose for the gander, and, you know, so across the board. So I'm anxious to see federally, you know, how they really begin to come up with some of the detail. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked earlier about the housing authorities and what have you, with having the, you know, you cannot, even if the wife is there, be a felon and come in and move in, and some of those barriers that exist. And this will help to remove some of those. But yeah.
And one thing in follow up to that, Senator Winters, is that I think you're right that. This is obviously a huge issue that has societal impact across the nation, and, you know, it will be interesting to see what guidance we get from the federal government. I think that my feeling is that there's a lot of work that we can be doing on the ground before we hear from them what they think about the law and think about codifying that kind of a thing. I think that regardless of how that turns out, one focus that seems of great importance to me and to our clients is making sure that we provide people with the services that and the assistance and the support that they need in order to show evidence of rehabilitation or show how they have mitigated the circumstances. And so I find myself longing to find a way to get more resources and more supportive services and outreach and community-based organizations who are in a place where they can help people establish a period during which they can then show that they've overcome whatever barrier there may have been in the past. So I'm really excited about those conversations and some of the great work that has been going on between housing authorities and community-based programs and others that I'm sure I don't yet know about in many of our Oregon communities. Particularly sponsors, I know, has done some incredible work. So thank you.
Yeah. Truls, I wonder if you could... Oh, I'm sorry, Paul. Did you want to say...
Go ahead.
From the perspective of community corrections and, you know, probation officers who maybe would have a role to play in this, what is your take on this?
Well, I think when people are on supervision, I think it gives the landlord more of a control and someone who can help. A lot of our probation officers and parole officers do work with landlords and try to be helpful because we want them living somewhere. Mm-hmm. So that's one part of it. And the other thing, and I think you guys probably talked about this last time, but I know Mercy Corps was helping us put together. Did you talk about the certificate
mm-hmm.
program?
Yeah, we presented and,
that. And those kind of things we think are helpful when people have demonstrated that they have proven themselves to have made changes in their lives, that they're reliable and will take care of the apartment or dwelling. And a lot of our folks that end up off of paper and off of supervision and then working for us, we have a lot of folks. We were just talking about someone who's working for Mercy Corps. That's a dynamite guy who has a felony record mm-hmm. and runs into these kind of barriers when he's a person who's been on the right track for about 7-8 years. So those are the folks that I really worry about, because once they're off our supervision, mm-hmm. we don't have the same ability to speak for them, to do those kind of things. And I think Commissioner Carlson mentioning about the risk assessment is something that we've talked about in Multnomah County, not just about the risk assessment, but assessing a person's home, where they're living, and their ability to maintain that home life. Now, that tool hasn't been developed, but I think there are things on the risk assessment that point to stability factors. Mm-hmm. There's some things, what we call static factors, are things like you can't change. You can't change your age. You can't change your criminal history. But you can change things like your employment and other things that show stability. So I think some kind of hybrid of that would be helpful. But I think, working with the parole officer, probation officer, if the probation and parole officer is working with the landlord, we find that can be very successful. And at the same time, to be honest, there are times we don't work with landlords because that may be a barrier in and of itself if the landlord knows that the person's on, because there's no other than for certain offenses. And Mike, you can jump in if I'm wrong on this. I think for certain sexual offenses and some other offenses, there's no obligation to let the landlord know that the person is on supervision.
Paul? If I can follow up. So I totally agree with Truls' comments in that I think we're talking about almost two different populations here. There's the folks that are coming out of prison that have relatively recent criminal histories that are on supervision, where we have the benefit of parole and probation, risk assessments. I'm a little bit reluctant about the use of risk assessment tools because the people who are at highest risk are actually the people that we want to see get into housing.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I think by saying we've got this risk assessment that tells us a lot about who the people are at highest risk would actually freak out a lot of landlords by saying this guy's, you know, really high risk, but that's the guy who needs the housing the most in a lot of cases. So I think there's a lot of education that needs to go along with how we talk about risk assessment tools and what they actually mean. In terms of the other population, those people that you talk about that have been off supervision, I think that's something, whether legislatively or educationally, I think there's a real need to figure out how we deal with that. 30% of the population now has an arrest history. 11% of adult males have a felony conviction. I've got a felony conviction from 20 years ago. I own my own house. I've never missed a mortgage payment. Yet if I were to apply for an apartment in any part of town, I guarantee you they would ask me if I have a criminal history. So at what point do we say, you know, we know empirically that, and I've said this before, that people who are able to stay out of trouble for 5 years or more are no more likely to commit another crime than someone who's never been convicted of a crime. So how do we deal with that population and give them a fair chance? I think that's one issue. And then the other issue is, how do we give opportunities to people coming out of prison? And I think there's education, indemnification, you know, providing some sort of fund for landlords to tap into if an apartment is damaged by a person with a criminal history is one strategy. But I think there are two different things here that we're talking about.
I actually think that both requires education of the community. I for the life of me, I don't know how we got ourselves in this quagmire. You know, and I go back a number of years when what we're talking about today is not as prevalent as it was during the years when we did work release and some of the other forms of public safety. And today we put in place, you know, so many barriers. I believe it was ACLU predicted that this was going to come back in 19, it was in the either 60s or the 70s, that at the rate that we were going, that we were going to have more men incarcerated and have felony records than we weren't going to have population. That's a whole other discussion. And part of it is that we created a culture now of fear. We created a culture of fear for those individuals who have gone in and coming back without the realization that 95% of individuals or more are coming returning back into the community. Mm-hmm. And so now we have to be about the business of figuring out how we're gonna integrate them back into the community. And most of them want to come back in and stay in and be productive. And so it becomes, how do we now educate the general population or the population, whether it's the landlord, whether it's the employer and others, that, you know, your return on investment is more greater if you actually remove some of these barriers than it was if you continue to have those barriers. Because you know as well as I do that when, you know, from you're talking parole and probation, if the person or persons don't have a place to live or to work and what have you, the chances of reoffending are extremely greater. Mm-hmm. You know, we're kind of guaranteeing that we're going to keep Colette Field and busy. Mm-hmm. I think both needs, you know, the form of informing and educating of the community. I know for us here in Marion County, we devote, and I will all speak for the commissioner and the sheriff and others, an awful lot of our time just doing just that, of trying to educate the greater community on reentry and what have you. So, mm-hmm.
Commissioner.
I was just going to say, going back to your original question about whether this task force wants to look at revising all or part of Senate Bill 91 and the conversation we had. So I'm looking. I have it under Oregon laws, but I'm assuming it's in the same order as the bill, Section 3. So it does say in the law that they can't, that a landlord can't use convictions that are more than 5 years old.
No, it's not convictions. That's
a general judgment against the applicant that was entered 5 or more years before the applicant submits the application.
Yeah, that's for the evictions.
I see. That's for the evictions.
Next section down. Yeah. That's about convictions.
All right. I'm looking at Section 3. Is it in Section 3 about, it says, when evaluating an application, the landlord may not consider an action to recover possession. Mm-hmm. So is that an eviction?
It's Section 3, sub 3.
Yeah. So sub 2, sub 1 is the eviction. That's where the 5 year.
But sub 2 says when evaluating an application, a landlord may not consider a previous arrest if the arrest did not result in a conviction. And then it lists a set of crimes. And so it's drug-related person, crime, sex offense, and so on. So I just came from a meeting less than an hour ago where our housing authority person, they're changing our plan to say that the only two things that they will look at are distribution or manufacturing of methamphetamine and lifetime
lifetime placement on the sex offender registry, because that's what's in the federal law, and they won't look at anything else. So I think this needs to be revisited with regard to, I mean, it feels like it's maybe out of alignment with what the current guidance is doing for us. So I just put that out there.
No, I think you kind of took the words right out of my mouth. I'm just wondering about this 5-year threshold, if we were to take that same language with respect to evictions and extend it to convictions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then so you can ask the question about crimes less than 5 years ago, but then certain tests would have to be done to, you couldn't have a blanket prohibition on, if someone has, it's been less than 5 years that they've been released. You'd still have to then go through a process of whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how we would actually word that, but, something along those lines. But, Paul, were you going to say?
I was just going to comment. I appreciated Commissioner Carlson's mention of, is it Marion County or Salem's Housing Authority?
This was Marion County Housing Authority. Hmm.
Because Sybil and I recently talked to Linn County's Housing Authority about this very issue. And each housing authority has a lot of latitude in how they set their policies. And so that's another issue. I mean, really, by federal law, the only groups that they're required to prohibit are the two that you mentioned. So I don't know if you have any other comments about that, but I think that this is also an issue that needs to be taken up by housing authorities around the state, because I think that what you'll find is the policies are very different from one county to the next.
Do we have any authority to tell housing authorities what they can and can't do? I'm just asking.
Well,
right.
I don't think that's why I go back to what I said earlier. The education approach, I think, has to be done. You know, like you're saying, what happens in Lynn is not the same to what happens in Marion or what happens in Multnomah County, for that goes. You know, they all operate independent of each other. And a lot depends upon actually the community in which they live and what's the engagement inside of that particular community. We happen to have a very robust community here. And so when you don't have that, I think you kind of, nobody's pushing the envelope, so to speak. You know, there's no need for making things change and happen. And so I do think that education is extremely important with the housing authorities across the state. I really do.
And if I might, I agree that education is incredibly important, and I think that, whenever we think, as you know, the Law Center, basically we can only represent a tiny fraction of the people who need representation. So whenever we're thinking about a problem that's impacting populations, we think about, is there a change that's needed in the law around what people's rights and protections are? And that's one question. And then an equally important question is, let's say you have a right or a protection under the law, do you have any hope of being able to enforce that? Do you have access to assistance? Can you get to court? Can you find a mediator? How do you bring your claim forward? And then there's also the question of, additionally equally important, education. Do you know what your rights are? Does the other side know what their obligations are, and how are we making sure that we're raising the level, the standard of practice, basically, in these kinds of scenarios? And I think that right now there is great confusion about what the federal law is, because it's changing, and it's also, they've sort of given us notice that they're still morphing. I think they're thinking about whether or not there should be cutoff dates or review periods. We don't know what their answer is going to be about that. But I think it's very helpful, and to the extent that your task force can think about not only the change in the law, which I think right now is as protective as it possibly could be. The federal law is what we've heard from HUD is fantastic. And I'm hopeful that we can work with partners on the national level to make sure that gets solidified in the broadest and most concrete way possible, so that we can then go about, enforcing that. In the meantime, I think we've got disparate impact theory already in Oregon state statute. We can bring cases. It's a question of, do people understand what the law is? Do they know what their protections are? And could they bring those questions forward if they had them?
So simple.
Could I just say, Jeremy?
Oh, Senator Winters.
Go ahead.
So, Sybil, could we make a two-prong approach to this issue? And one that is not only educating the individuals to know what their rights are, but also educating the or talking to the housing authorities even before the federal actually clarification comes in?
Absolutely, Senator. And many people, I think Ryan Fischer was here at the last meeting, and he's done great work. His association's doing great work in reaching out. And I think he mentioned that Meyer Memorial Trust has a grant. The Law Center is a partner in that with housing authorities and with landlords. Deborah Imsey has been a part of that as well. So we've been going across the state. You know, we'd love to do that in, you know, quadruplicate or whatever the greatest expansion could be, because there's just a great need. We're uncovering great questions.
That was going to be my thought about the education versus legislation issue is with the issue of Section 8 vouchers. It was pass the law and then educate people and be a little bit more sort of carrot for the first year, and then, you know, if people didn't want to take that education, that's when the stick got brought down. Do you think, I mean, so I guess my question, that's just my kind of thought, is that we sort of try to pass something that extends the five-year mark for convictions and then try to educate around what that would look like, you know, over the course of a few years with something like a Meyer Memorial Trust grant, you know? I mean, is that...
I think education is always a fantastic tool before, after, and during, you know, legislative changes, because I think that's very much part, you know, of whether or not something gets implemented in the way it's intended. I'm wary of passing legislation on the specific criminal history standards before we hear more from what the federal government is going to do. I'm interested in thinking more about that and learning more about that, and I'm trying to coordinate with my colleagues in other states about that same question, so I don't have any, you know, final thoughts on it. But I feel like if we think about the sort of three prongs of what are your legal rights, what's the education and knowledge, and then what's your ability to enforce, those are the three prongs I sort of approach things with. I feel like the legal rights are good right now, you know, and we're still waiting for a little bit more detail from the feds. I wouldn't want to codify something in Oregon state statute that ended up being narrower than what the feds decide to do. Our statute right now is currently, it looks a little narrower in some respects, except that you have the disparate impact theory that's also codified in our statutes, which would be applied to any challenge to a negative decision. I mean, I think you can craft the right legal case if you're talking about legal questions and legal protections. I don't know that people understand, and I don't know that people have the ability to bring their case forward or to get enforcement or accountability if there's a violation. So I feel like my interest right now is on the other two prongs, and maybe services as well to help people figure out how they can rehabilitate and show evidence of mitigation.
Okay, I was asked just a follow-up real quick. In terms of, like, trying to pass something that limits landlords' ability to use criminal history past 5-7 years, from a legal standpoint, do you think going about, like, if we tried to pass... say someone tried to pass that without really discussing the separate impact and just saying they paid their dues, it's time to, you know, the sort of the evidence shows that they're no more likely to reoffend after 5 years than the average person on the street. Is that from a legal perspective a dangerous road to go down in terms of, or I'm just curious.
I have two kind of answers to that, and one is that I think, you know, that question is something that we talked about in the Landlord-Tenant Coalition prior to passage of the bill in 2013, and I think there was discussion about the Landlord-Tenant Coalition at the last at your last meeting, which I just listened to on tape, so I may have missed some things. But I think that, you know, I would maybe have some legal concerns about it, whether or not it was sufficient to address the issue and to accomplish what I understand to be the goal of this task force. And then I also think, just practically speaking and in terms of working with our partners, I would want to talk to the landlords about that and hear their thoughts. But mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it again, that goes back to a blanket line, mm-hmm. and I don't know how well that works.
Cool.
True. I just had a just want to see if I'm hearing you right. So when you're saying by not going the legislative route and waiting on the federal government to further define that we may have the way the federal government interprets it may be less restrictive to our folks.
That's what
to
I'm
the
hoping.
Folks impacted. So that's what I like about what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it gives us a little bit more leeway and to be a little bit more creative rather than locked into this 5 years, which I think is a good, if we have to go a route like that, I think that's a good way to go. But right. if we can be a little bit more going case by case, I think it gives us more flexibility, as Paul was saying.
So I hear what everybody's saying, but I just want to throw this out for one more thought. And, you know, I get what you're saying, that we don't want to jump too quickly. And the issue is we have this task force and we have an opportunity to bring forward a report, and then sometimes the political opportunity goes away if you wait 2 more years, or if we wait 1 more year, maybe the short session would be the answer to farther. But here's what my feeling is. Number one is I would like to get away from the background check, whether or not the federal government says it's good or bad, completely, because we're learning there's no research relationship between a crime that's committed and future action. We're learning that in pretrial assessment. We're learning that everywhere. And so we talked about it with the university standards. I can't remember what meeting that was, maybe last meeting.
Last meeting.
Right. Yeah. It feels so long ago. So we're basing our law on something that has absolutely no basis in evidence. Secondly, there are so many problems that I've run into, more anecdotally, I guess, but I think people may confirm this, with different companies that provide the background checks and what kind of background checks they provide and what they say on them and the inability of people to interpret what they're reading. And so even though the law says, well, you can only look at conviction, you can't look at arrest, when you've got the piece of paper in front of you and the arrest record is this long and the conviction's there, it's like telling the jury in a courtroom, don't listen to what you just heard. It still has an impact on people, and I think it still creates discrimination. And so if you don't have the background check in there at all, you avoid that larger problem. And then the third one is, while I hear what you're saying, too, about that you can provide the proper case, I would say probably 99% of our guys, and women, too, but we're the ones that are hardest to place are the guys, that are looking for housing, if they were turned away, they're not going to take a case to court. They're just going to they're going to put their head down and say, well, I was rejected yet another time. They don't have mm-hmm. that legal representation. So to rely on case law and the ability of lawyers to represent people and file cases to make sure that we're doing the right thing is concerning to me. So I just want to put all of those factors out there, and then we can go forth the way the majority feels we ought to go forth.
Right. Well, you know, my thinking is very much aligned with yours, Janet, in that, and I don't know if this is possible, but if we could take that population that has been, rehabilitated for 5 years or more, just take them off the table, then, I mean, there's no way that the federal law could be more, could be less restrictive, because we've taken that off the table, just as we've taken arrests off the table, arrests not covered by conviction. And then for those who are, who've offended less than 5 years, we'll see what the federal guidelines are, mm-hmm. right?
You know, I'm sitting here struggling, and I don't know what's magical about the 5 years. I don't know what's magical about, and I agree with Janet in the background check, and I don't know when we started all this nonsense. And you guys all know I come from a different place. I come from a time when, you released and you move back into society, and I have no greater person than my deceased spouse. So suddenly we put all of this stuff in place, and now we're sitting up here talking about 5 years, 3 years, 10 years, whatever, for somebody to prove whatever. And I'm sitting up here trying to think, well, what's magical about 5 years? What's wrong with the person having done their time, paid their debt, making their way back into society without having all these albatrosses. I sit here and I think we have so become a part of this system out of bases of fear, out of a basis of legislation that we have passed, including Measure 11 and others, that have put all this in place to the point that now we're struggling with trying to find how to unravel it. How now to unravel it where, because we know we can't continue to build prisons in this state. And let's be honest about, you know, some of the reasons that we're doing some of this. And I'm trying to say, well, can't we come up with something that's very simple? You know, I live in a very simplistic state of mind. And I'm trying to figure out, why is it 5 years? Why not 3 years? Why not, you know? I'm sure that, you know, you can tell me about individuals coming in your caseload that comes right out, and they're ready. They're ready. Mm-hmm. You know, where you might have somebody else in your caseload that you know that you're going to have to watch 24/7. So I'm just trying for my own edification.
Yeah, let's pursue that idea.
Well, I think your point's well taken, and you as well, Commissioner Carlson. I mean, conviction is a static factor. We can't change that. And in most cases, it really has very little bearing on us telling anything about a person. I think the challenge is electronic records. The advent of electronic records and the internet has put this information out there for everybody to see, and we can't unravel that without putting in some form of protection for people. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you move to another state, you start over, no one knew, no one cared really. But now that information is viral, and even without, you know, there's the electronic record that says you have a criminal history, but then anybody can do a Google search and see that you were arrested and you were in the paper 5 or 10 years ago. So I think that in some ways we have to figure out some sort of protection if we really want to change this, because you know, when we started putting this information out on the internet, it's kind of like the cat was out of the bag and there's no pulling it back without some form of protection. But this isn't a protected class, so how do we protect them?
That seems like the most, that's the simplest answer. Let's make it a protected class and then we can walk away. Yeah, I mean.
Really is the challenge.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, pursuing this question of the 5-year threshold, is there a period? I mean, Paul, you've used the, you know, that timeline, and SB 91 talked about 5 years in another context. Is, you know, is there any value to 5 years other than it's more than zero and less than 10?
I mean, that's where the research shows. There's been a few studies that have been done that show that they looked at people and their likelihood to reoffend, and they came up with, after it was like 5 to 7 years, that you know, the lines were going up and down, and they kind of leveled out with people in the general public, and they were no more likely to reoffend than someone who had never been convicted of a crime. So that's where that comes from. I don't think it's a magic number. I think it's based empirically on a bunch of research that was done.
Mm-hmm. And,
sure. And we can look at that research. Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to share it.
And again, I think if someone had housing, I don't think they'd be apt to reoffend because they had a place to stay, or if they had a job, you know, they had something to preoccupy them. They wouldn't reoffend. I'm with you all at the other end. Do away with it.
It's not a criminogenic risk factor, but it's a stabilizer. It's one of the things that we know is a stabilizing
housing,
factor for people.
It's housing. Mean,
mm-hmm. And there's another thing that I've witnessed in the 24 years I've lived in Northeast Portland. All the housing for low-income people is east of Portland. I know that I'm just talking about Multnomah County, and that is having a different effect on North and Northeast Portland in terms of who can live there and who can't. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another impact that that this has on people of color in being part of Multnomah County anyway. So I agree that just not counting that as a, if we just not have it as a, consider it at all, I think that would be a better way to go.
I would be curious, Sybil, if you have any thoughts, what would be the impacts? I mean, could we legally ban the use of criminal histories in housing without facing serious blowback from?
Well, I suspect that would be a tough thing to do. I don't know. I can't speak for folks. I haven't considered that. I think, to me, you know, the law right now, the state of the law, if it's, you know, as the Supreme Court has decided and as HUD has indicated, is that you can't, you have to do an individualized assessment and see whether this person's background creates an actual risk. And that, to me, feels like the right analysis. It either does or it doesn't. And, you know, I want people to have the tools to figure out whether it does or not, and I want them to do that in a good way, and I want people to have the ability to bring their cases forward and be assured that they're going to get a just determination of that fact. But I don't disagree that that fact, that analysis is one that is useful in the context of housing or employment or anywhere else. And I think if you, it's, I mean, I don't want, I don't, I should think about it more closely. I think one of the other things to think about is, you know, if there is a risk that is not being assessed at all, does that create other issues for other folks in housing? So, you know, I think about that in the context of domestic and sexual violence a lot, because a lot of the work that we do is with survivors. And I think this came up in the context of your prior discussion with respect to the school policies, and they're kind of trying to think about those balances as well. So could you blank? Probably legally you could, I bet. I don't know whether there would be blowback or concern from the other perspective.
I wonder if we couldn't, as Serena just mentioned, look at kind of the ban the box.
Expanding that.
Yeah, because that doesn't say you can't use a criminal history. It says we're taking it off the application, so we're encouraging all people to apply, and we're giving people the opportunity to put their best foot forward and offer them this housing before we run a criminal history check.
And in many ways, my thought is that that's exactly what the current law requires. Uh-huh. What the state Supreme Court decision and what HUD basically are saying is, they don't talk about when you can ask the question, and I guess that's another analysis that you could make or decide. But what they're basically saying is, when you ask the question, you've got to do it in this way and only to consider whether or not, you know, it's recent or it's relevant. And so I think your question about background checks is really very connected, and that's a concrete, I think, very specific piece of this process that doesn't work very well right now and could be improved greatly. And I think that's a technical piece that you could improve that wouldn't run into the risk of potentially narrowing the coverage of the federal law, and would help regardless of where, you know, HUD comes down as they further clarify, is one thing, other thing to think about.
If I just add, though, a thought, though, when you're talking about running the background check, it's not the landlord that pays for the background check. It's right. Generally the applicant that pays for the background check. And if they're applying to 5 or 6 different apartments because they're worried that they can't get in, and it's $75, $80, whatever it costs for them to run the background check, I'm an advocate for a woman. She makes $703 a month, and $85 is like a huge part of her income. It creates a big barrier for people. And if, again, I think the intent of running the background check is for the landlord to feel like they know whether this person is risky or not. But it's not really telling them that. It's smoke and mirrors. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it gives somebody the false impression that, yeah, I'm doing something that's going to help me know, and it doesn't really help them know. And if research is saying that there's no relationship to it, I mean, that's a big piece of the education that we have to get across, too, because as a state and as a nation, we're relying on background checks to all make us feel better that, oh, well, we checked that person's background, and so therefore we know if they're a bad person or a good person, and we don't know anything other than they had a conviction or an arrest. We don't know what their risk is.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask a clarifying question. So are landlords doing background checks on all applicants, or just those who check the box that say they have a criminal record?
I just had my son, got him an apartment a couple summers ago when he was here, and everybody had to have a background check, including me, because I co-sign. Yeah.
Okay, so that's kind of a different problem.
And The landlords obviously could speak more specifically about, and you know, I'd be interested in what they had to say about how they do the background check process. And I think Deborah at the last meeting was talking, and she referenced a Washington State statute that just passed that basically that said sort of instead of the landlord doing it for every single person and the tenant having to do, you know, pay that fee every time, the tenant had the ability to go get their own and then bring that one report. They pay the fee one time and bring it to a number of different places. And I think, you know, some of the questions that come up, and I haven't delved into this in great detail with Deborah or other landlord representatives, so I'd want to do that. But one of the things that I think we see is that, you know, there is sometimes a level of inaccuracy in background checks. So that's sort of a separate problem. When you get a background check, that's a static snapshot, right? And so, you know, how long should it be acceptable for a tenant to use that? There's some expiration date probably on that time frame.
Yeah, and that, and actually that issue is on my list of things that I want us to talk about. You know, is that an area for us to go down? You know, that is, you know, it's obviously closely connected to our conversation about ex-offenders, but it probably has larger ramifications as well, and would, but, you know, could do a lot of good if we could figure out a way to come up with a system that would free people from having to do, you know, background check after background check after background check.
And, excuse me, Mr. Yeah. Chair. No. What kind of discussion has been taking place with respect to purging?
To purging?
Of records.
So like for expungement, that kind of thing? I'm not aware of current discussions. They may be happening and I don't know about them. In the past, I think what I have been aware of is that they, you know, obviously there are criminal defense attorney, prosecutor sort of discussions that have happened in the past about that. I haven't been a part of them. What I know in the past when we tried to look at expungement or purging of eviction records, we ran into electronic problems in terms of actually removing records from the database. There's an expense in doing that. When we last looked at that, it was prior to the courts, to the judicial system having moved to their e-filing. And so basically, we had conversations with trial court administrators who said, please don't talk to us about this until we're done with this transition, because they had different systems in different counties, and they didn't have a uniform way to manage it. So that's different now, and it's possible that it would be useful to look at that again. I don't know. You would need to learn more about how OJD manages that stuff. But I think eviction history is a huge barrier to folks in terms of accessing housing, and some of these same issues come up in that context as well.
If I may,
yes.
In which vein, it seems to me we also need to figure out some sort of incentive. I mean, you're right, evictions are a big deal, and we know that people that take rent well classes, there are some things that people can do to mitigate a past eviction history. But I'm just kind of thinking out loud if there isn't some way to incentivize landlords to rent to people with criminal histories. I mean, it's hard enough for people to find enough money to get into housing once they've got out of prison. And then they're up against competing with everybody in the public that maybe doesn't have a criminal history. So is there something we could do to make this population a little more appealing to rent to? Whether it means setting up a pool that would create a fund if there's damage to the apartment, or waiving criminal background fees, something, because I think that the bar is still pretty high.
I think one thing when I think about it, something that's been in my mind is that for people that I keep going back to the Section 8 thing, but when it sort of became illegal to discriminate against people with Section 8 voucher, I know a couple, I don't know which specific housing authorities did this, but they set up kind of like a deposit pool that would help people pay the deposit. And so they could get over that hurdle to get into housing if it was a financial barrier. But setting up something like that, that obviously would benefit the person with the criminal history looking for housing, but also maybe put a little bit of extra money in the landlord's pocket, some kind of state-run assistance fund. That money talks, I think, and that's I don't see, that seems like the easiest ways to change people's hearts and minds is.
I think that's a great idea, and the concept of the RentWell program, I think Ryan spoke to you about last time, is sort of that if you go through this program and you learn about your rights and obligations as a tenant, you sort of are also kind of connected to some assistance, financial assistance, whether it's deposit or application fee or damage payment, and I think that's an incredibly successful program. It would be, I think, very useful to bring it back and make it available to this population. And in terms of just plain old, I can't pay my rent this month because something terrible happened and I need to stay, you know, I need help just staying in housing. There is also a fund that's set up at Housing and Community Services called the Emergency Housing Account, yes. And it's mirrored with the State Homeless Assistance Program, EHA and SHAP are their acronyms. And we, the legislature kindly, greatly increased that fund last session in through a temporary allocation in recognition of the deep crisis that many communities are in, and we hope to solidify that and further increase those resources. And that basically works by going to local community programs who are very connected to client populations and who are, you know, working in the community, who can help sort of facilitate the administration of those funds.
Yeah. You know, even with those programs, I used to direct one of those programs in Portland. Even if there was someone had a felony or something on, as long as we as the organization signed and said that we would track them for 6 months, the landlord would still let them rent there. So again, we talk about the 5 years, we talk about the waiting. There was an organization that backed this person, so is there something that, an organization that backs these folks when they're coming out, going into the community, that says that we will watch them, we monitor them for 6 months, they'll be okay. Also, when they went through the RentWell program, that's pretty much the same thing, mm-hmm. regardless mm-hmm. of what their background looked like, as long as that organization, or as long as they went through RentWell, they were okay to rent.
I think that's just that, in our opinion, from our clients' experiences, those programs were incredibly effective. And it's sort of like a combination of support and kind of tracking and education and assistance, plus some financial backing. And many times, I don't know what your experience was, but we found that the community organization was able to kind of maintain communications with the landlord or relationships with the landlord, and so there were partners really and
absolutely
helping.
So I guess that's what I'm saying is, why would they have to wait when you have organizations who could help with this process? And again, it didn't matter about their background check because they were connected. So is there a possibility? And the housing programs, they still do that in the community-based organization. So can that process still continue? Again, doing away with the background check. So, because it doesn't matter when you're connected with that or if you went through a RentWell program.
Well, we've got a lot to chew on.
And,
yeah, I think, my sense is that this is an area that, you know, you want us to spend more time on. We don't have a clear path of where we want to, where we want to go with this, but I'd really welcome your thinking more about it and letting me know between now and the next agenda and the next meeting. We'll put it on the agenda again, come back to it. Maybe a couple of us could meet with the landlords and get a kind of reality check from them on this, and let me know if you'd be interested in being part of that. Thanks a lot, Sybil.
Thank you also very much.
Thanks for being
here. Really appreciate your work and the time.
Great. the next item that came up last time that, I had a sense people were interested in pursuing was the one around suspended licenses. And, you know, we talked about the problem of suspended licenses directly with respect to people in pre-apprenticeship programs and, you know, House Bill 2986 a few years ago, which we passed, which created a pathway to, for them to get their license restored provisionally, you know, if they'd lost their license as a result of, actions related to their convictions. if they were in a pre-apprenticeship program, and we talked about perhaps doing another set of legislation that would extend that to people who were apprentices in apprenticeship programs once they were released because they had done pre-apprenticeship while they were inside. And I got a sense that you're interested in pursuing that. But that led to this broader discussion of, well, you know, maybe we should be looking at licenses, suspended licenses more broadly. And, you know, to be honest, I hadn't fully appreciated just how much this has become a real topic of discussion nationally. And I thought that just to kick off our conversation around it, if we could just have us listen to, there was an NPR series on the challenges that poor people face with respect to our criminal justice system. And they had a focus on this very issue just a few months ago, which I think kind of puts a human face on it. So could we listen to that?
NPR's Joseph Shapiro explains.
Here are the penalties for serious...
...is a serious penalty, but often drivers lose it for things that have nothing to do with unsafe driving, like the failure to pay court fines. That is a penalty that hurts poor people the most and can even keep them stuck in poverty. NPR's Joseph Shapiro explains.
Here are the penalties for serious driving offenses in Wisconsin. If you get caught drunk driving, it's your first offense, you lose your license for 9 months. For hit-and-run driving...
Well, you get a one-year revocation for that.
That's researcher John Poisserat.
Even though they've left an accident causing bodily harm, they get a revocation for 1 year.
But get this. If you don't pay the ticket for a minor driving offense, you lose your license for 2 years. Like if you get stopped for driving with a broken taillight, but then you don't pay.
It's well beyond any other penalty.
So, hit-and-run driver, 12 months, broken taillight, don't pay the ticket, 24 months. Does this make sense?
It's an incredible policy. A policy of punishing people who can't pay their fines.
It's a policy we found repeated in states across the country. People who don't pay their court fines for nonviolent offenses, mostly for driving violations, get their driver's license suspended. It's a twist on an NPR investigation that we called Guilty and Charged. That showed the rise of court fines and fees, and how the costs, that can reach hundreds or even thousands of dollars per person, most hurt poor people, like the people who live in this neighborhood.
We're pretty much in the heart of Milwaukee's poorest neighborhoods.
Poisserat runs the Employment and Training Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He studies these neighborhoods block by block to understand the barriers to getting a job, like having your driver's license suspended, and how losing it can set off a spiral of bad consequences for the poorest people.
2 out of 3 African-American men in this neighborhood of working age don't have a driver's license and are consequently unable to access the jobs that are beyond the bus lines.
If you have a suspended license, man, it hinders you because most jobs are not in the inner city nowadays. So the inner city jobs that we have are not able to provide for our families.
That's MacArthur Edwards. He was stopped by police and ticketed for driving with a broken light over his back license plate. When he didn't pay the $64 fine, his driver's license was suspended for 2 years. He kept driving and got more tickets. He's 29 now. From time to time, he gets hired to work in warehouses around the city. But those are temporary jobs, often at around minimum wage. This month, he doesn't have enough money to pay both the landlord and the light bill. He wants to be a good father to his 4 children.
And I want my kids to look up to me. I want my kids to be like, man, my father did that, you know, or I need these, or I want these, or the school said I needed this, and I can't afford to buy it, or I can't provide for my children, you know. I don't want that to be that way.
Recently, he responded to ads for long-distance truck drivers. 2 companies promised to train him, but not until he's got a valid driver's license. So he came to the Center for Driver's License Recovery and Employability, where lawyers and caseworkers helped him get his license. They arranged for him to pay off $600 on the $1,800 he owed, then clear the rest with community service at the food pantry.
All right, so you had your road test last week, correct?
Case manager Angela Catania helps him with the last step, to set up the road test he needs to pass.
Okay, and how did that go?
It went fine from my point of view.
Okay.
But I failed it.
Do you have another one rescheduled?
Yes.
Okay.
Statistics from Wisconsin's Department of Transportation show that the most common reason people lose their license is because they don't pay the fine on a ticket for a non-moving traffic offense. Those make up 56% of all suspensions in Wisconsin. Nationwide, one study found similar numbers. About 40% of suspensions are for unpaid traffic tickets and for things like not paying child support or getting caught with drugs, things that have nothing to do with unsafe driving. People with money pay off their tickets and are done with the courts. When people don't pay, a minor ticket can set off a chain of problems, like for Angel Hinton, who also came to the center for help.
I always parked in that same place for 2 years. They never ticketed my car.
Hinton had a small janitorial business. Money was tight, so she challenged the parking ticket she got outside of a suburban office building she cleaned on Sunday mornings. But the unpaid ticket meant she couldn't renew her car registration. She then got more tickets for expired tags. She missed the court date. She says she wasn't notified. That triggered an arrest warrant, and one day she got stopped by police, pulled out of her car, and handcuffed in front of her young daughter. Without a license, she could no longer drive to the places she cleaned.
This basically ruined my life. I mean, I was to the point that I'm building my business, I'm growing, and now I'm back to depending on public assistance.
People should pay their tickets, no doubt about it. They should be held accountable for what they've done that violated the traffic laws.
Jim Gramley is a former municipal court judge. He helped start the Center for Driver's License Recovery. Retired on a Friday, started working as a volunteer lawyer on Monday.
But at some point, a balance has to be introduced into this. And the balance is, if people don't pay because they're low income and can't budget that expense, what's an appropriate penalty?
He says most judges never ask people if they have the money to pay traffic tickets. So he argues for alternate penalties, to let people pay in small monthly amounts or arrange for community service instead. And the retired judge lobbies state lawmakers to end the 2-year suspension on failure to pay a ticket, a penalty longer than the suspension for drunk driving or hit-and-run driving.
Don't let those suspensions sit on low-income people and prevent them from getting the license they need to get to and from work, get a job, or just live like everybody else.
Municipal court officials declined to speak about the policy of 2-year suspensions. But the threat of losing a license does push people who can pay to pay. Still, a new analysis of city records by the nonprofit Justice Initiatives Institute says there's no evidence that the long suspensions stop people from driving and getting more tickets. Mostly, the report says the 2-year suspensions just put poor people more in debt. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
Thanks, Shelley. And, you know, this really does seem very timely. You know, we've heard about, you know, the tragedy in Minnesota, Minneapolis, where, you know, the fellow who was killed when he was pulled over had just, he had a large number of issues just like this. Ferguson, you know, we saw a lot of problems there where people were being given tickets and suspensions, and a lot of the further offenses were really just related to failure to pay, failure that they had warrants out there because of that, and people getting into spirals. And so we forwarded to you, you know, along with these, the links to these NPR programs, also a recent report done by the Association of State Motor Vehicle Departments. Everybody has an association, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, where they a few years ago provided a set of recommendations that state lawmakers look at these laws. The U.S. Attorney General's office has just done the same thing and you'll see in your materials a link to the letter that they sent to the state, suggesting that we look at this. And so I think it makes sense for us to look at this. So I'd like your, you know, I'd like your thoughts.
I'd like to look at it, but I'd also like to know, and I'm sorry I wasn't here at the the last meeting, but I'd like to know what happened to Project Clean Slate, because the genesis of Project Clean Slate was to address individuals who had, you know, misdemeanors, traffic citations, and what have you, and so that they could get their licensing back. I've heard several stories, but what's happened to it, and then what's going to replace it is there going to be a replacement? And I see Lou is leaning forward.
Well, I'm leaning forward because there's a long answer to that, and I'm not sure whether we have the time to go into it. Put simply, there were some questions that were brought up about Project Clean Slate, not answered yet, but questions, and there was we now have nothing taking its place. That we do have a particular approach that is being suggested, but it's not going to deal with those small, those minor offenses. Instead, it's been suggested by one of the judges in Multnomah County that it, instead of dealing with the small offenses, he wants to deal with people who are just coming out who have larger offenses that need to be dealt with. It is very disheartening for me, because one of the first Project Clean Slate day I worked that day and saw people who I knew who were in situations where they were not able to pay traffic tickets, and as a result were so far in debt, or they had suspended licenses or things like that, coming up to me in tears saying, now I can do this. Right now, Project Clean Slate does not exist, and there's a lot of discussion about how we can perhaps recover or do something similar, but that is not being supported at this point. So I'm not sure where we are. It is exactly what we were supposed to be doing, and it's not a good situation.
Rick Parrish. Yeah. I've just kind of been sitting here listening the whole time, but
yes.
the driver's license thing for me is like the biggest stick in my craw issue that I would really like to see us address next year. Just from having, you know, watched this with my own sister and never being able, she died in Multnomah County, still kept sending us, fines, like, you know, please pay your fines. I'm like, that's not going to happen. So, I had 2 years ago, I think it was the Department of Justice came in, and we were talking about all the fines on the books, and, you know, Rep. Gomberg said on the House floor this year, you know, there's all this money in uncollected restitution. And I'm like, what I learned from that, from having the Department of Justice in my office, was that apparently, whether people die or not, that just sits on our books. So I think one of the things we need to do is, you know, clean up our books and figure out what money is really out there. Because the fact is most of these folks coming out of our justice system, if you're, a mom coming out of Coffee Creek with $17,000 in DMV fees, and these are real stories from real women that I've, you know, when I've been inside the walls and having these conversations, you know, that's what people owe. They're never going to get, that's worse than student loan debt. They're never going to get out from underneath that. So, you know, how do we maybe use the fees that somebody has on their driver's license as an incentive while they're behind the walls for good behavior, and having that sort of tick marked off so that they leave with no fines? I think that there's a lot of ways we can get at it, but the reality is, if we're looking as a state that this pool of money is somehow a resource to the government, I think we're kidding ourselves, because, you know, some people will truly go through and do the work to get those fines paid off, or if they have a sibling, you know, I've written that check to DMV multiple times. The fact is that, you know, we're not going to collect the bulk of that money. So, you know, if it's going to mean that somebody like my sister goes back into the prison system for $40,000 a year, was it worth it for a $2,000 fines on her DMV? And the answer is no. So this is one that is personal for me. It's something I think we can address and tackle. It's not a soft-on-crime issue. It's just, it's a practical dollars and cents issue that, you know, it's not real money. It might be sitting there on our books as uncollected asset, but it's not real money for the state.
Thanks, Julie. Yes, Lou?
Well, we're going to talk about another bill that we brought up before, and I'll mention it. But I'll say there are a couple of aspects of this. One is we do not have a Project Clean Slate right now. That's something that we should have. And every time I brought it up as something that could be replicated in other jurisdictions, other counties, every district attorney I talked with said this is a great idea. The problem then becomes who does it, and that's where we ran into things. And I'll mention that in the presentation on 4123, because that was what we ran into there, was who is going to be in charge of this and who has the responsibility for it. Julie Parrish is right on the mark on this. This is something that we overestimate how much is available, how much is in fines that should be coming in, and we underestimate the societal impact that these fines have, because people coming out of prison are not going to be able to pay some of these fines, and that just keeps them in debt and keeps them psychologically stressed trying to get something done.
Lou, I had a woman tell me one of the last times, not I was at Coffee Creek for the TASTE program the other day, but one of the last times I was actually in for one of the programs that I was there to speak on, but I had a woman come up to me and we were talking about this issue, and she, you know, she's like, look, I've got tens of thousands of dollars of fines, and I feel like when I get out, I'm probably going to have to commit one more crime to find a way to get these things paid off. I mean, she was just really blunt about it. Like, I have no other path. I don't have, you know, the skills and the education. I don't know where I'm going to come when I get out of prison. You know, I've got a family I've got to go and try to take care of, and I just feel like, you know, I'm probably going to have to do one more thing, you know, to try to wipe this off, you know, whether it was selling drugs, selling sex, selling whatever, to get that. And when I hear that, I mean, it just lights my hair on fire. So, and though, you know, that's a real conversation from somebody who's, you know, waiting to get out right now. But in her head, she's got to go do one more thing to go and try to, you know, get her slate wiped clean. And I just, you know, it breaks my heart.
I think we need to, I've mentioned this before, there's an inmate at Coffee Creek who works in a resource center. And she did quite a bit of work with the judges on her multiple cases and was able to convince one of those judges to give her the opportunity to have her $18,000 worth of fees wiped if she was able to make payments while she was still in prison. So she had to do quite a bit of work to find a bank outside that would allow her to set up a fund to make these payments for money that she was making while she was in prison getting paid to do the job that she was doing in prison. And the Oregon Justice Resource Center is setting up a visit to go down and talk to this particular inmate to get details as to exactly how she did this. And I'm sorry I don't have the judge's name, the two counties, the bank's name, but the Oregon Justice Resource Center was going to set up a visit to go talk to her to find out exactly who the judge was and exactly how she did this. But I agree with looking at how to completely get rid of some of these suspensions and fees. But if this inmate was able to do this, this might be something that we want to look at as to, you know, at least who are the allies, who are the judges, who are the folks that are, who is the bank, who are the people that are willing to work on this issue with us. And I will take ownership of working with Oregon Justice Resource Center to get that information to this committee next time.
Chair Dimmer?
Yes, Paul.
It would be nice to maybe do some sort of environmental scan just to kind of get the scope of the problem. And I see Cindy Booth here from DOC. Anecdotally, what I can tell you is that, you know, probably two-thirds of the people that we see coming out of prison have lost their driving privileges. And so we're in the process of usually just getting Oregon ID, in some cases working with them. But it's very different from one court to the next. We're talking about municipal courts in some cases for a lot of driving stuff. And then for people that may have felony driving while suspended or DUIs, we're talking about different courts, circuit courts. And some judges are much more willing. We regularly take people to municipal court to talk about working on payment plans, and some judges are very willing to do that, particularly in Eugene and Springfield. But a lot of times when we're taking people to Junction City or Coburg or Florence, we get very different responses. So I think that there is no, you know, one-size-fits-all approach to this, and the problem is pretty big. But I don't have any idea the extent of the actual problem and what the average amount of debt is that people have.
I was just going to say, we took a look at Clean Slate for Marion County. We were very interested in doing it. Our district attorney and myself and a few other people went up to Portland and went and talked to people, the DA up there and so on. One of the things that we discovered was that there's a unified court that's the city of Portland and the and the county court. So it's all in, so circuit, municipal, they're all in one, which made Clean Slate much, much easier to do there. Because if you have a municipal, we have 20 cities in Marion County, not all of them have municipal courts, but a handful do, and then Salem has its own municipal court, and then we have an unincorporated areas of the county municipal court, plus the circuit court. So all of a sudden it just became like trying to herd so many cats that we sort of set it on the back burner. And then of course, Representative Frederick, it was the same question about then who runs it once we figure that part out. But the first part was also very cumbersome for us. So one of the, you know, it's always been kind of in my shelf of things that I'd like to pull off and look at again. But it would be, so what are the elements that are replicable? Because we did get forms, and, you know, I saved some of those things that we might be able to implement, and the community service pieces and that type of thing. But I think education amongst the different judges, when getting back on that, is going to be key if we're going to ever be able to move something like that forward.
I should also point out the Department of Corrections put together a pilot project with DMV where they're getting people their licenses while they're still in custody. So there is a process in place, but it's only available at certain institutions.
And I was just going to point out that Project Clean Slate, actually you had a lot of misdemeanors.
Right.
And you didn't have...
No, it wasn't felonies. It was it was misdemeanors.
There were misdemeanors. Yes. And so, you know, we're talking about felonies, so you're also talking fees and assessments, and not necessarily traffic citations and what have you. So right. I think clearly there's a, I mean, I have to look at probably both, but I would just guess that if we did and got some data out of Department of Revenue, as to how much is really on the books, that actually are traffic citations and what have you, it's probably staggering.
That you're right.
Yeah. But I do agree with Rep. Parrish's point that our chances of recovering that money is very slim. So, you know.
Well, and Michael, I just want to say, you know, there is legitimate driving. Like, if you get a DUI, I'm not advocating that that person maybe gets their license back right away or, you know, but some of these driver's license-related issues are, you know, Sally committed a crime and was pulled over, and the crime didn't have anything to do with her driving, and, you know, and she gets this felony driving while suspended or, you know, something regarding the license, and, you know, so it's sort of in conjunction with another crime. I mean, that was usually my sister's case. She gets pulled over. She doesn't have a driver's license. She was, you know, running some ID theft or some other type of crime, and it just compounds. And so, I mean, I think, you know, if we had to get into separating out, like, true traffic offenses from sort of this other piece of the driving issue as it relates to, you know, you didn't have a driver's license in the process of committing a crime, but you weren't necessarily pulled over because you were speeding or something, you know, like, then I think that we could break that out a little bit, but, boy, I think we just need to find a way to solve it. And I will say Clackamas County Courts, Judge Herndon, who's the, you know, presiding judge there, he's on board for this in our county. You know, we know it's a problem, and we know there's a cost when people don't have the tools they need to come back out the right way, because it's just, you know, part of that revolving door, you know, that actually when you look at our recidivism rates, you know, that kind of, we usually look at the long-term recidivism, but we're not really tracking as well the short-term revolving door of, you know, somebody gets picked back up and they're in jail for 2 weeks and then they're back out on their probation. I mean, that if you start factoring that in, that really boosts our numbers up there in a way that I don't think, you know, we've really talked about. But the driver's license piece is a big piece of why those folks are struggling. The other thing Judge Herndon said is, like, you know, we're a big county, Clackamas. You know, you've got someone on probation out in Estacada. They're supposed to come into Oregon City for their, you know, parole or probation meeting for a drug test or whatever, UA, and they can't get there, and we don't have a bus. So they have two choices. They can either drive without a license because they don't have a ride or they don't have public transportation, or they don't show up. And either way, they're in trouble. So, you know, the system just kind of perpetuates itself because of all of these other pieces that, you know, exist as someone's trying to at least be on a right path. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, the report by the State Department Motor Vehicle Administrators goes into some of the costs that, you know, that the state or local jurisdictions have to pick up enforcing these driving license suspensions, just how much police time is spent with stops and the, you know, the kind of thing that you're talking about as well. There is a real legitimate cost that accrues from having such robust suspension policies.
I heard that Washington had, I'm sorry, yeah, had a law that they just passed. Is that true? Around this?
They did. They passed a law, we should probably get that up on the website as well, that removed a number of the crimes. Mm-hmm. I think failure to comply, right, maybe failure to appear, were taken off as you know, leading to license suspensions.
Just wondering if we could look at mirroring that as something, yeah, that came out of this task force.
We should also look at, in the story they mentioned child support,
yes,
arrears, and I'm not sure if that's still the case in Oregon, but it used to be you would get your license, deadbeat dads, mm-hmm, were regularly lost their driving privileges for failure to pay, and to me that just seems so counterintuitive and productive. Well, I guess so. But, well, you know, if you want a person to be able to work and pay their child support, taking their driver's license away.
Well, let me say that a significant percentage of the Project Clean Slate clients were dealing with that particular issue. And what happened within that whole effort was that you had people coming into Multnomah County in order to be able to go through Project Clean Slate, where they had situations, they had issues that were in other counties, but they knew that they could get them settled in Multnomah County, so they would come into Multnomah County to get those things settled, and especially the child support.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of child support, some years ago, DOC and the Department of Justice instituted a process where at intake, people who had child support arrears were able to submit a form to the Department of Justice, and Cindy, you can probably inform us more about this, but basically stop their child support from accruing while they were in custody, because a lot of people would wind up with thousands and thousands of dollars in additional arrears. I wonder if there isn't some way to do something similar with the driving fines and fees, just putting that out there.
That is something we've talked about. There
are other fines as well, and I'll mention that in a minute when we talk about the other thing that have issues regarding interest accrued on fines that are court fines, and then you continue to have interest accrue while you're in custody.
Isn't the state accrual rates stiffer than your normal?
In some cases, that's true, yeah.
Well, and I think it's after so many days, 60 days or whatever, then it just goes to collections, 30 days or 60 days, and then you just get...
That's another story.
Yeah,
that's
I'll mention that as well.
I think I'm sympathetic, but I'm also cautious. And the reason I am, because I think one has to have some responsibility for some of this. And I don't want to go down the path of where they think that we're not holding people responsible for their actions. I just have to put that out on record. Don't get me wrong. I embrace Project Clean Street, a slate, funded it several times because I thought it has extremely good merit. And I still think it has good merit, and if there's some way that we can actually make it statewide. But I also don't want us getting off into areas of where, to such a degree, that we won't be able to get anything through these chambers. And so, you know, I like what you brought up of what was going and looking at banks in other ways of helping. She did not, she satisfied her debt. She worked on it. And I think we need to, you know, figure out ways of doing that, as well as figuring out ways of can we in some way do clean slate. I think it was it did some very good work. And like Janet said, we looked at it in Marion County and to see if we could emulate what was being done in Multnomah County.
Well, I went around. I went to Lane County. I went to Linn County, Benton. Columbia, Washington, Clackamas, to talk about this as a possibility. Each county has its own issues that you were mentioning, trying to get around, but there was a basic issue that they wanted to deal with. It costs money to have that case. For each case, when you do catch that person, you then have to go through a court situation there, and that costs additional money for the courts and for the DA and for the sheriffs. If you could get break through that and not have to spend that money, that made a difference as well. So that was part of the whole effort. Again, I'll mention this in the next thing.
Yeah, and I think we probably need to move on to that next topic. But let me just say a couple of things. First of all, following up on Jen's point, a couple of us were at a meeting where the Multnomah County DA talked about a program that he had heard about in Minnesota Corrections, which involved a kind of a savings account program for inmates, where they were, they were essentially able. I'm not sure if they were working with private banks or exactly how it worked, but it was a program designed to allow inmates to have savings accounts and to use them to pay off their fines, to start doing that, or to have money built up in their accounts that upon release could be used to pay off their fines, which he was very excited about what he was hearing. So, you know, I think that's something that we probably want to look at, do some research on as well.
Excuse me, Senator Winters, wasn't Maryland doing something like that too when we went to that NCSL committee meeting? And they had something very much like that, as I recall, too.
A savings account kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
I believe we have that ability right now in Oregon.
I think so. I don't think we.
Could you come up for a sec?
And I think that group, there was a group.
Sorry, you shouldn't have come, but you did.
Dangerous to sit in our audience.
I know that we have people that are regularly making payments on court fines and fees while they're in custody.
But will their judge expunge the rest of their fees upon parole if they don't? And that's the piece that I want to find out about.
Hi, Cindy Booth, Oregon Department of Corrections, Reentry and Release Administrator. I think what Mr. Solomon is referring to is the Inmate Reentry Savings Account, and also the department is working on a restitution account within that. So for several years, probably since 2000 or 2002, we've had a reentry savings account option at one of our institutions, a primary releasing institution, as a pilot. And one of the difficulties is it's a manual accounting process right now. So our accounting system cannot literally handle widespread. But we are exploring options for how to do that. through other automation that we need to move to anyway. So it will be an opportunity that will be available to everyone. And there were discussions in the Governor's Reentry Council and elsewhere around what is an appropriate amount of money to allow someone to save toward reentry before any DOC fines would be taken, and how we could work to help them pay down restitution and things like that prior to their release and still walk out the door with an amount of money that is worth, you know, that good first step out.
Cindy, question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned talking about a limitation on before any fines or assessment. I'm assuming that you're talking about paying the assessments of what internal to the department?
Correct.
What if I reach that threshold, what would incentivize me to actually continue saving?
And that's why those are continuing discussions and no decisions.
Because it would seem to me that two things we want to encourage. One, we want to encourage the individuals to save and to be responsible to pay whatever, and also to where they've got more than our typical gate money, so that they have enough to where they can actually know that they can be self-sufficient, somewhat self-sufficient when they get out the door. So that's an interesting thought process that you guys are having.
Can I just, real fast, Jackie, you know, we're talking about getting people to pay, you know, back. One of the things that strikes me about our fine system is, you know, when this gets, it's sort of like student loan debt. You know, when it gets turned over to collections, it starts, and we use collection agencies to collect these fees. You know, that's where people really start compounding, right? It's like, not only are we going to try to get the base fine, but if it's been sitting there on the books, you know, and it goes to a collection agency, now you're talking about, you know, kind of a profit for the collection agent who is going to, you know, have an interest associated with that, who's going to have late fees associated with it, and it just suddenly they owe more than what the fine really was. And so maybe there's room there as well to try to look at, you know, if maybe it's not a full waiving of it, but maybe we rethink how we do the collection side and, you know, with the interest charges and the fees, the additional fees that fall on top of these.
Yeah, I want to go back to that because I don't know what the average inmate would be making, number one, to where they have the ability to save. And I like those numbers, whether they're in Oregon Correctional Enterprise, but what on average, it doesn't seem to me that unless they've got probably a super outstanding employment, that we're talking about their ability to save a lot of money. You know, to me it's kind of like, you know, the conversation is how can we enable the individuals to save, and how, you know, we encourage. Because one of the things I think that some of us who've kind of, and I'm going to speak a little bit from pro and probation, the individual of individuals coming back into the community, we have so limited their ability to think for themselves, including saving dollars, riding buses, and seeking employment, how to get, you know, all these kinds of things. I would think that as much that we could encourage them to save inside the institution, it would be beneficial for all.
Agreed.
I think that's true. I think the challenge is you've got 14,000 people in custody and the state has limited ability to pay people more than a few cents an hour. So you only have a handful of jobs where people are earning anything that's of any significance, and they're also paying for their hygienic supplies and stuff while they're in custody. So unless we start creating more jobs in custody where people are earning more, I don't know that people are ever going to be able to save anything meaningful.
Well, Solomon, that's a whole nother discussion. But I mean, right now we're talking about the ability or trying to create the ability to save and to encourage it, and I think that the most we can, as much as we can create inside of that environment, the same environment that's on the outside, the better.
Agreed.
You know,
so,
Yeah. Julie?
So can I just ask, you know, whoever might, somebody be from the Justice Department, you know, system, yes. Corrections might be able to know this. So let's say Sally, you know, goes into prison with a DMV, and, you know, what happens to that account where there's a DMV fine? I mean, is it theoretically, you know, she's going to be in prison for 4 years. Is that account theoretically turned over to a collection agency while she's there, and it's accruing interest and fines while she doesn't have the ability to really work for more than whatever it is that her prison job pays her? Because, you know, if they're, as I understand it from some of the inmates, they're under the impression that, you know, older fines that have been on the books for a long time that are already over with the collection agency are actually accruing interest and, you know, additional charges while they're sitting in prison and can do nothing about it. And if so, then again, I think that's, you know, another path we can look at to try to keep these fines rational.
Right. Yeah. Do you know the answer to that, Cindy?
Reparation, Senator Dimper, I do not know the answer to that. I don't know what happens for the DMV system. When the individual comes up for reentry planning, we look at what they're eligible for from the Department of Motor Vehicles, if they do have a current record on file, and if they have a suspended or revoked license, we will work to get them an identification card instead. And if their license can be replaced or renewed, then we work with that as well, provided that the record is not too old.
And I would just add, this may be old, outdated information, but when I used to work restitution collection in another county, Clackamas County, I know that the courts were not, the system was not set up to notify the court, each court, that this person is now incarcerated, mm-hmm. So the hold off on paying the fines or whatever. Basically, if they met the timeline for sending it to Department of Revenue, it was sent to Department of Revenue, and which is then went to collections. So I think you're the woman on the phone, I'm sorry.
Yes.
You're absolutely right, yeah. That it's it keeps accruing from what I've, unless something's changed.
Just a point of clarification.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem. I think there's some things that actually they feel bite around the edges, but if we address them, they're big bites, you know, and this is, like I said, this one just sticks in my craw, and I really want to solve it in 17, so.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll see what we can do to get it out of your craw, Julie. we'll do some research over the next week or so and see just what, you know, what we're dealing with here. And it sounds like people are interested in our addressing this. And so, you know, we'll put it on the agenda for next time. Truce?
Just one more comment, Senator Dimbrough. On page 13 of this one, the access to driving and license suspension policy for the 21st century, they have some recommendations I think we should look at. I didn't get time to read all of this material, but on 13 they had some ideas about consolidating fines to one place so you didn't have all these different courts, and some other recommendations I think that might be helpful.
Okay. All right. Well, let's certainly you just got this material, I think, yesterday or this morning. We'll have time before the next meeting to do some digesting of it and some recommendations. Thank you, Cindy. For those of you who are on the internet, this is all available on our task force webpage. All these reports related to suspensions and everything else we're referring to here. Yeah, Jen.
I'm just looking at the agenda. Before we moved past House Bill 2986, I just wanted to comment on something. But if we're moving to 2986 now, then we're there.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was actually thinking that we would go to 4123 because I'm not sure. Is there anything really that we need to talk about with 2986? That was the one with the pre-apprenticeship, and I was just trying to get a sense of my sense was that we did want to look at extending that to the regular apprenticeship programs.
One comment as I was reading this, it does, and I don't know how to look at this with a legislative or a lawyer eye, but there is language in there that says if the person is enrolled in a pre-apprenticeship program as defined in ORS 660. or is a registered apprentice under
And so I'm looking at this language and saying, if this language is saying what I think it's saying, then perhaps we have an issue of education versus legislation with this particular bill, because some of the folks, the pre-apprenticeship programs, have no idea this exists. And then I think a lot of folks have no idea how to use this if this language is reading that whether they're apprentice or pre-apprentice, they can go to the DMV and get a provisional license. If that's the case, people don't know how to use this bill, I think is probably one of the bigger issues. Or it's not reaching the right people, or maybe there's a different issue with it.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Actually, I hadn't, even though I was the sponsor of the bill, I hadn't realized that we'd included apprenticeship as an option.
Well, and that's why I'm questioning I'm reading it completely in context and it's as simple as it sounds, or if there's other issues that we're not aware of for the implementation of it.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for that, Jen. Okay, let's talk about House Bill 4123. But before I turn it over to Luke, because I think this will take us, you know, certainly to the end of the meeting. I also put an item on the agenda, and this is actually something that came from the Governor's Reentry Council. A concern that people that perhaps the state or local governments are not doing as good a job as they could be of being of setting models, being models for employing ex-offenders. And are there some ways in which government should be leading by example in ways that we're not? And so we don't have time to really talk about that this time, but be thinking about it, if you would, and be prepared to talk about this next time. And if you have relevant examples or suggestions, this is an issue I think we need to address. But having said that, let's go back to the discussion 4123. Lou?
Sure. So let me sort of go into this. We've already actually talked about a lot of this before. And like many bills that come up, it came up because I ended up in a conversation with a group of people. They were previously incarcerated folks who were trying to get back on their feet, but they found themselves facing debts. Now, these were not restitution debts, because that's not what I was trying to deal with. This was not a bill about fines as part of a sentencing. It's also was not about folks who were dealing with child support in this situation. This is about folks who were struggling because there was a debt that surprised them and frankly surprised me. And those were court and supervision fees. These debts are in suspense during incarceration, but they became due and began accruing interest upon the release. The collections clock began ticking the day they were released, and we're talking about folks who often come out with no assets, no job, often without a home. Within 30 days, he or she needs to either pay these debts in their entirety or commit to a payment plan. If they're able to get employment, they may face wage garnishment. They'll be referred to private collection firms, fees, who will then call at all hours and do all sorts of other things. And if they do call at all hours, which happens to be illegal, who are they going to complain to? So they know that the hole gets deeper. The hope required to find and deal with the parts that they can deal with slips away, and the hope of making it out of that hole may die. And at a certain point, sometimes, as Julie was mentioning, sometimes prison may not seem that bad, or going back into to dealing with crime or something is not that bad. So this is an attempt to provide a light at the end of the tunnel. And the idea is a very simple one, really. And everyone seems to like the idea, which is that they could pay off that debt using community service. The problem, of course, then becomes who supervises them. Whether that's, huh? Well, that's believe me. What happened when I proposed this in February was that the fingers went like that. No, you do it. No, you do it. And we ended up with a bill, and then we amended it, and then we found out that there was one group that was had not been didn't feel as though they'd been consulted, so we amended it again, and we ended up with a number of things, a number of groups of people, the Department of Corrections, Judicial Department, Parole and Post Prison Supervision, and a number of and the Association of Community Corrections directors all got involved in this. That the question became, who was going to supervise this? And we came up with an idea that, in fact, first of all, the idea would be to have a community resource, community-based organization, be the one that comes together on that. That it's turned over to a community-based organization that is then. That the other agencies can, in fact, check in with. That's the idea. Now, I plan on reintroducing this bill in 2017, but we'll see if we can get people to work together to get something like this to happen. It's an issue of, again, supervision of that community-based organization and whether that's going to be the county folks who are doing it, or the judicial department. Everyone wanted the county folks to do it. The county folks were not real happy about that idea because they don't have the capacity to do some of these things. So this, everyone recognizes the problem, everyone likes the idea, but the question is who gets it done? And I don't have an answer for that right now, a solid answer that I'd like, frankly. I'd like to be able to have more conversation.
What kind of plans did this apply to? Hey, Lou, talk to me offline because I think I have at least an idea that might address the logistics and maybe make that a little easier.
Great, Julie.
So let's chat offline.
Of course.
What kind of fines did this apply to?
We're talking about these are court fines.
So anything that's related to the courts or community corrections? Or
well, these are supervision fines.
Fines, yeah.
There were some folks who were being released in terms of parole who were getting a bill for their parole visits.
Supervision fees, right?
Supervision bills.
Right.
Yeah. Supervision charges.
We charge right. That.
And they, I mean, I'm just not in that system, but if you've been released and you're struggling to pay anything, and then suddenly there's a supervision charge as well attached, how do you do that? If there's no money coming in because you don't have a job yet, how do you do that?
So I'll
just say that I know it's the practice in the two counties I've worked in that when someone comes out on supervision initially, there can be a waiving of the supervision fees. And we often will waive supervision fees until the person is stable, has a job, and is able to pay. There are even times when we will forgive a larger portion of the supervision fees to incentivize them paying restitution or taking care of other matters. So we do have some control on our end. Typically, when people get to the point where it goes to Department of Revenue, it's been something that they haven't addressed with us in any kind of cooperative way. So more could be done on that, I know, and I'm sure it can differ from county to county. But that's how that happens. Typically, the fees can range from, I think some counties charge as little as $25 a month. And I think it goes, is $40 a month is the most I've heard, maybe?
Those are the supervision fees.
Yes.
Okay, and I understand that. These folks that I ended up sitting in a room with, we're talking about fees upwards of $12,000 and $15,000.
Right. Oh yeah, wow. That's normal.
So it's probably more court fines.
It's huge.
And they were
it's a combination of
the it's all combination. Yeah, right, and they just sort of looked at me and said, "How do you expect me to pay these fees when I can't get a job?"
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we can find a so the proposal that I had was basically to try to find a community service system that would allow us to do something with that.
I think the question for me is And that's trying to separate out what the fines are, because we've gone from supervision to some of them are court fine to some of them, and probably a combination. If they're reaching 15 grand and 20 grand, there has to be a lot now yield to parole and probation, since this is something that...
I would say it's the typical person on supervision is around 3 years, so that would be very difficult to get that high just on 3 to 5 years. 5 years is more unusual, but 3 years is more common. So that would be, it'd be really hard to get to that amount just on supervision fees.
Right, yeah, sure. But it's a compounding, so it's the interest.
No, it's a combination.
That,
this is not just supervision fees.
Right.
But there are court fees, and I've been told that these court fees are for copying something or something. I mean, those are the kind of talking with
the cost of the
case itself, and different courts in different counties put different levels of fees there.
And just to speak to supervision fees, just to help you a little bit, another idea maybe to add to what you're talking about is individual counties do what I'm going to tell you. I know Multnomah County, we have some amnesty programs where we send letters to people who are in arrears and say, hey, come in and pay whatever, some percentage. I don't know the exact percentage. So if they owe a couple of $1,000, that they pay that percentage and we forgive the rest just to get them back in line. So I think that might be something to look at statewide.
But it varies from county to county.
That's what I'm saying.
You know, I mean, if you look at probably Curry and Coos County, where they're struggling in their community corrections departments, that money goes into their budget, and they're probably not trying to give away very much of it.
However, what we found is when we have people who aren't paying, we're probably not going to get that money anyway. So what we see is a bump in revenue. I know we have a lot more people on supervision, but we see a bump in revenue because folks come back into the system and start paying. So
what happens when a person goes to prison that's been on supervision, absconded for a year, racked up fees? Do those fees that accrued while they were on supervision and come back out of prison 2 years later, they're still on the books?
Yeah. They don't get charged while they're in prison, but they do come back. They follow them back out.
So that's the proposal. That's what I'm working on. I want to try to get this, if possible, have it make a dent in this at some point. And I'll talk with Julie about it, because she has some ideas. I'd love to hear them.
So if I may, what I can say is we do a lot of community service stuff for the sheriff's office as a nonprofit reentry provider, where they send us people that are doing community service. And so I think there are nonprofits like us that could act in that form or fashion.
Perfect.
But it takes our time and energy to do that, and without any additional funding, I think you're asking for a bit to ask for the nonprofit community to take this up without some way to pay for kind of the administrative overhead of operating it.
Got it.
But it is possible, and I think there are a number of us that are doing it already in some way.
Can I make one more suggestion? Because we're looking at this for restitution.
No,
I know, but I'm giving you an idea that we are using for restitution, because the way I understand the statute around community service is community service has to be done for a nonprofit or public agency that's imposed by the court.
Right.
What I think it doesn't apply the same way to restitution or fees, and our attorneys have told us that we can allow people to if they're working for. Not necessarily a nonprofit agency, a for-profit business that would want to sponsor them to do that. That those fees could go to paying the restitution or whatever fees they have, because it's not imposed as a penalty. I mean, the work isn't being imposed as a penalty. It's just providing an avenue for the person to do the work. Our problem has been trying to find people who would take it on, for instance, like graffiti removal around the city of Portland. If we had some corporate sponsors that would pay for that effort, and the money that the particular person on that crew was making from the corporate sponsor could go to pay their fees. But
that's
what we are.
Idea. Yeah. So I mean, it sounds as if. You know, the barriers to the bill's passage were both, you know, who would be in charge, but also the financial implications of it. Mm-hmm. You know, who would pay for the work? The courts would have challenges with it, particularly in those more rural counties.
I think your county as well. Have you talked to Chief Justice Bowman?
I've talked with him briefly about this, but very, very briefly.
Because I would think that the courts, not just the rural counties, but the bigger county is your county. Then when you start looking at revenue, and so I would just encourage the conversation be held with the courts, since they're doing most of the imposing here, and then try to get, you know, some agreement with them. And I also, I personally lean towards parole and probation only because they've been at this and been involved with so many years. And actually probably the one entity who is connected with local resources and what have you, you know, is around the state is your parole and probation people. I'm not sure of creating a new entity because you've got to get them, try to get them up to speed to understand, you know, all of the ramifications and ins and outs. It's going to take them several years to get there. So, but I would encourage that some before we come in, that some real conversation be held with the courts.
Mm-hmm. So your notion is that parole and probation would oversee it. The work would be done through community-based organizations.
Right. Well, let me talk with parole and probation about that because they were not.
Well,
and they were concerned about.
Well, they're not going to want to do it without resources.
Right,
that's the whole point.
Right. Yeah.
That's the whole point. We have to employ people to supervise and manage all that. And Multnomah County, it might be in some of the bigger counties that might be easier. But as Paul has pointed out, some of the smaller counties that can be a huge burden.
Yep, right. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Was there a fiscal impact to the bill when it was? Did anyone run that at all?
At that particular,
probably didn't get that.
We
far.
Didn't get that far.
Okay, yeah. So that might be a next step as right. to maybe Foster the County. Directors Association could do some sort of a little survey or something, and mm-hmm. yeah. see what it would take.
Well, so maybe Lou, you and I, and Julie, and Truels, whoever else might be interested, can try to convene some parties around this.
That'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could I ask a question?
Yeah.
What is the difference between court-imposed community service and volunteering for an organization such as Habitat or Rebuilding Center? Does everything fall under community service, or when someone would get community service in lieu of a fee, are there only specific places and organizations that they can fulfill that requirement through?
Yes, the way I understand the statute is that when a court imposes community service, that it has to be done, and the statute says that the defendant has to voluntarily agree to do it, and they usually do because they don't like the other consequences, which could be jail or other things. That it has to be done for a nonprofit or public agency. Right. Some community service programs are. Like in some of the bigger counties have work crews that contract with ODOT or Parks and Rec, and they go and they're reimbursed by ODOT to do their crews, much like some of the jail crews, and then that community service is done that way. Some also have relationships with nonprofits in their community where they'll send appropriate people to those nonprofits, like Habitat for Humanity or the food bank or something, and that they'll keep track of those hours at that particular agency. Mm-hmm. I know in Multnomah County we probably have 50 different agencies we use, mm-hmm. but again, that's a management thing because you have to manage those agencies and track all that information. So,
does the person have some control over where they get sent? And the reason I'm asking these questions in terms of pre-apprenticeship or apprenticeship. Could this, you know, do two things for the person paroling? One, reduce their fines, and two, get them some volunteer work experience that is specific to something that they are trying to enter in terms of employment.
That would really be the, in my view, that would be part of the community-based organization that would set this up.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that they would, you know, want to want to make sure that people are doing something they feel comfortable doing as well.
Okay. That may be too rational, Jen. Sounds good.
I'm a very simple person.
Great. Okay, well, thank you. We've already overextended our time, but we've covered a lot today, I think, and but unfortunately settled very little. So we have a lot of work still to do, but I feel like we're really getting at some very meaty issues, and where, you know, there's a potential for us to really do some good work. So please mull over what has been talked about today. If there are particular kind of topics or issues that we've touched on that you would really like to be involved in addressing, let me know, and we will move forward. Okay. Yes, Julie?
Michael, just real fast, you know, one of the things we might consider, because, you know, I mean, we might get some pushback from counties or whatever, and they go, this is a revenue source, but, you know, I'm on a different task force, and we brought in kind of some outside help around the Willamette Falls locks, and one of the things that we're doing on that group, in that work group is, you know, kind of doing that cost-benefit analysis. And maybe if that's something we put forward before anything passed, we actually appropriate a few dollars to bring in like an Econ Northwest or something to actually, you know, pick a county and say, or, you know, small, medium, large type counties, but pick three counties and say, okay, you know, what does it cost to run these things off your books? You know, what is your rate of collection on all of these things? Because one of the other fees that's out there that's not just probation fees is work release fees. If you're in a work release program, you know, you're paying $500 a month or whatever to a work release program, not from the prison work release, the DOC, but a county work release program, and you have to have a job, right? And you have to be able to, all those same issues Lou just brought up, except now you're in the, you know, sort of the confines of work release. And so we might consider, you know, actually going, okay, but what's it cost to run them through your court system again? And what's the cost to have a sheriff go pick them up when they fail to show up for, you know, their probation or UA or whatever? And I think that you're actually going to find that that cost-benefit analysis, you actually would save your folks money than, you know, waiving this pot of money that people, you know, continue to think is there, but it's not really there. So that might be something just to, you know, to do some cost-benefit analysis and offer that support to the counties as we make these kinds of decisions.
That makes a lot of sense, Julie. Thanks. Okay, everyone. Well, with that, let's call it a close for today. I will close this meeting of the Reentry Task Force and see you all in a month. See you all in a month.